Good. Okay, so today is August 8th, right, 2012. I'm Rick Hansen. And I want to, I've been reflecting on something partly related to my own family situation or a piece of it, which I'll spare you the gory details, although you'd probably love to know, but I'll preserve a little zone of privacy. And my talk tonight is called Wake Up to Good News. And I've been very preoccupied with this subject. You may even see a Just One Thing from me on this topic very, very soon. So what do I mean by that? So I want to hold forth a little bit, discuss it, then I'll hold forth a little bit, we can discuss it, then wrap it up. Okay. So it's interesting to reflect in Buddhism on what are called the three poisons, or in the Buddha's original terminology, the three fuels for the fire of suffering, namely three words translated in English typically as hatred, greed, and delusion. I personally think there's a fourth poison or fourth fuel. It's implicit what the Buddha said, but it reflects the fact that we're profoundly social animals. It's the fourth fuel of heartache, broadly defined, that creates issues in our relationships. However you think of it, though, fundamentally, one of the three or four fuels is delusion. And arguably, it's the primary fuel of all. Because in the Buddhist analysis, the fundamental source of our suffering and our harms is ignorance, which is to say, delusion. And the fundamental breaking of the chain that shackles us and binds us to our pain and locks us, that ties us down sitting on the hot plate, is our ignorance of what's really true. So waking up from delusion is central to practice. I think it's also central to living happily and in harmony with others, and it's central to having a world full of 7 billion people that can live in peace and sustainable prosperity. How do we wake up, and what are we waking up from? It's interesting to appreciate as well that metaphorically or literally, on the night of the Buddha's own awakening, what was his greatest challenge? It was the forces of Mara, represented in the Hindu pantheon as the forces of delusion or ignorance. And so Mara came at the Buddha in many, many forms, as a temptresses, demons, wars, opportunities for great power, trickery, and again, the Buddha found his freedom from that ignorance in two kinds of ways. He reached his hand down, he touched the earth, he drew upon the forces of nature and fundamentally said, I have a right to be here. I have a right to see what's true. I get to be here. And he recognized Mara. He said, I see you, Mara, again and again and again. And that's what it takes, doesn't it? There we are, we're sleeping. We have a typical dream, we feel uneasy, something's coming to get us, we're being chased, we can't get away, we feel slightly paralyzed as if we're running through water, we try to strike and our hand moves slowly, we can't call out, right? And then the alarm bell goes off, the cat jumps on the bed, a bird chirps outside, something, we wake up from the dream. It's a little weird for another few moments, but then it's behind us, it was just a dream. We wake up, we see clearly, we recognize it for it was. I see you, dream. Or, as I'd like to explore with you, I see you, false belief. I see you, false truth that I have believed and entrapped myself by. I see you, the purported and yet empty bars of my own cage. So I want to talk about two kinds of seeing. An ordinary, everyday, and yet very important kind of seeing. Talk about it a little bit. And then a deeper, more fundamental, more radical, more fundamentally liberating kind of seeing. So to the first kind, I invite you to think about waking up to good news in your own case. What's the bad news? The Kool-Aid that you've been drinking from. And I want to mention three fundamental categories. So one category is a sense of feeling needlessly threatened. What's the bad news there that you could wake up from? And wake up to good news that actually you're not so threatened. Actually, for example, that ongoing trickle of background anxiety is lying to you. Instead of signaling you that there's actually a threat to be vigilant about, it's just noise. That's waking up to good news. There really is no tiger about to pounce. You know? How about feeling threatened about the world at large? You know, all these ominous news, all this and that. Have you noticed that most of it doesn't change your life at all in any material way? It changes our heart. Our heart may go out to those people, but it doesn't change our life itself in any material way. Or think about our anxiety that if I do X, Y will happen. If I speak from my heart, they'll slap me down. If I ask a professor for a letter of recommendation, they'll laugh me out. If I write my book, no one will want it. If I do an art show, no one will come. You know, that presumption of threat, right? Is that actually really true? Or alternately, is there some good news you could wake up to by simply recognizing Mara, simply seeing the bad news that we've been deluded by? Or take, for example, the good news that's actually available to us in the realm of feeling rewarded. The good news that's available to us, for example, in opportunities out there in the world. Because of the brain's evolved negativity bias, which kept our ancestors alive, we routinely tend to overlearn from pain and underlearn from pleasure. And we overestimate threats and underestimate or recognize opportunities. So speaking of opportunities, think of the opportunities that there's been a presumption that are not for me. You know, reaching out to other people for a relationship, asking people on dates, creating ideas that, hey, maybe we should do this together. It could be kind of cool. They might like that new recipe for dinner. You know, opportunity to try different things and have it go well, right? Those are other areas where we can wake up to the good news of what's actually possible. And then, of course, there is the third major category, relationships with others. In other words, what if the good news is they actually really like you? What if the good news is that they know you're an asshole and it's okay? I don't know if you ever took the S training. This is going to be a little PG-13 language for a moment here, but you know, one of the fundamental teachings of that, for me, remarkable workshop created by a, you know, an imperfect person, Werner Erhard, but like many great things created by imperfect people, I'm imperfect as well. Anyway, you know, one of the great teachings is to realize that we're all kind of clunky. We're all goofy. We're all imperfect. We're all animals. We're all messed up. We're all assholes. And I remember sitting at the table once when our kids were probably about 10 and 13 or, you know, 9 and 12 or something. And my wife, Jen, and I, who had both taken the S training, were just kind of on a roll. And we were joking around about this. And we realized our kids were, of course, as preteens often are, early teenagers, very morbidly self-conscious, right? And so Jen and I just started playing around. And I said, well, you know, Jen, you're an asshole. And the kids just were totally freaked out. And then, you know, it's like, she said, well, you're an asshole too, and that's all right. And they were like really freaked out. And we're like, Forrest, you know, you're an asshole. And he was like, whoa! Now, you got to understand what I mean by that. But it's like we're all afraid that if we were actually really seen, people would be disgusted. Guess what? We're already seen. And they like it. They're okay. You know, maybe the wonderful good news to wake up to is that we're actually already seen, basically transparent. Foibles, farts already smelled, okay? And they still like us. They still love us. They know we're kind of a jerk sometimes. We have a temper, whatever. We're kind of needy. We whine. All right, you know? We don't. Our breath doesn't smell very good in the morning. Whatever. They still love us. It's really okay. Groups want you to be part of it, part of them, you know? That's good news, too, to wake up to. People want to know what you want. Because when they don't know what you want, it drives them crazy most of the time, especially men. Anyway, so I'll just keep going there. So I'm sure it's true for women as well. Anyway, so you see, there are a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of good news, I think, to wake up to in the relationship sphere as well. All right, so let's talk about this a little bit. What do you think about this idea of waking up to good news? That is good news. Occasionally, I want to say this. Occasionally, we have to wake up to bad news, right? We have to wake up and realize I'm drinking too much, or it's not cool to just dump my anger into the space, or I've played small, I sold myself out, I was kind of cowardly, I lost my nerve, I didn't stick up for myself, right? I'm naming all kinds of bad news I've personally had to face. I deserve to feel remorseful in some way. Or this relationship is a tunnel with no cheese, at least for this kind of mouse. All right? Plus, sometimes we have to wake up to the bad news. Or I did something with decent intent or neutral intent, but it had negative impact. And inadvertently, without malintent, out of ignorance though, I got something to learn here, I caused you pain. I got to let that in. I got to wake up to bad news. But as a guy who's been a therapist one way or another for 35 plus years, most of the time people need to wake up to good news, including what a fundamentally good person they are in their deep nature, without a halo required. Fundamentally fair, fundamentally determined, fundamentally wishing well, fundamentally willing to pick themselves up when they've been knocked down, get up, endure, and keep going. Good news. What's your good news to wake up to? Christine.
Well, that's a little bit off. Neurologically, bad news is more stimulating than good news. So I guess you just make good news more stimulating. It's something that I've found interesting to. I know 5 to 1. And
yeah, all that. Yeah. Yeah. Right. I'll comment briefly, which is that, pardon me, what Christine says is actually really true. It's interesting that, how can I put it, if a noise that's unpleasant and a noise that's pleasant that are equally loud, the unpleasant noise will be associated with more brain activity, which makes sense in terms of our ancestors. On the other hand, we can really sensitize ourselves to the positive. And I'll say something in passing here that's actually very, to me, interesting and has been revelatory from brain science and pretty cutting-edge brain science. It's simply this. The brain in general and its sort of salience detectors, its valence detectors, in other words, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, which is the hedonic tone in Western psychology or the feeling tone in Buddhist psychology. The center of the salience detection circuit, you know, carrot, stick, or move on, is the amygdala. Now, if you, let's say, have 100 people in a study and you present them with positive, neutral, and negative stimuli, the group as a whole will have a response in the amygdala that looks like a U. In other words, negative stimuli, high response, neutral stimuli, low response, positive stimuli, a pretty high response, even in the amygdala. Okay? But then when you break down the 100 people, as it were, into subgroups, you find 3 fundamental subgroups. Very interesting. You have people who react more or less equally to positive and negative stimuli in the amygdala itself, which is not the entirety of how the brain responds, but is really very much at the center of our emotional response system, especially at the most basic level of approach, avoid. All right? Then there's a second group who respond highly to negative stimuli and only mildly or moderately to positive stimuli. They tend to be quite aversive. And then there's a third group that responds mildly to moderately to negative stimuli. They you know, don't run out into the road in the middle of traffic. They pull their hand back from the hot plate, but they respond highly to positive stimuli. In other words, the contrast for this third group in response to positive compared to neutral stimuli is much greater for them than the contrast in this group in their response to negative stimuli compared to neutral stimuli. In other words, they are full of approach orientation. Part of the setting of the amygdala is constitutional. Some people are born, they tend to be more aversive types in Buddhist psychology. They tend to be stick averters, you know. Other people tend to be born more positively oriented. They tend to be more greed types, carrot grabbers. But people can be really trained. You can tune this circuit, if you will, in the salience or valence response system through life experiences. You can tune it toward the negative. It's adaptive if you're in a crappy situation, if you're in a refugee camp, you're growing up in an abusive home, or you're living with violence and poverty all around you, to tune your own personal amygdala to be very threat reactive. Okay? On the other hand, if you're in an environment where things are pretty good and there are plenty of opportunities, it's adaptive to tune your amygdala, as it were, to be opportunity focused, to be approach oriented. In other words, to see the good news. A lot of us grew up in environments that weren't that great, whether it was the kids at school or the neighborhood or the family environment or early experiences socially with intimate relationships. I don't know how many of you would like to go back to seventh grade all over again, you know? We learn from that, and because the brain is primed to overlearn from the negative, we tend to often overtune in a negative direction, and then that becomes the presumed new normal. That's why very often when we wake up to good news, not bad. We wake up from a negative, threat-focused dream to realize that we're actually surrounded by carrots. Yes, watch out for the sticks that are real, right? But mostly when we wake up from the dream, we're surrounded by carrots inside us and outside us. And one of the great ways to tune your own personal amygdala in this positive direction is to take in the good. You know, is to do bhavana, cultivation, to incline the mind. You know, as the Buddha said, whatever the mind frequently rests upon becomes its nature. You know, yes, see the sticks, see the threats, see the tigers out there in the world, but don't be in the nightmare dream of thinking that you're surrounded by tigers when they're just paper tigers. And when you find carrots, when you recognize the good in yourself and in others and in the world, really let yourself have that positive experience. So gradually over time, you tune your brain so that it's more has more of this approach orientation. Any other comments about this level so far? Waking up from your, again, ask yourself, what's my good news? There's often an intuition in us. It's like a hope. Yet we're afraid to long for it, you know. Or there's often a fear that if I actually operate as if there's no threat, that's when I'll be really smack silly, right? So we have to push through that to recognize that actually there isn't a threat out there. It's exaggerated or non-existent. So any comments about this idea of your of waking up to good news? Oh, great, thanks.
Was there a risk of deluding yourself on the good news? And
totally.
Way too much, or where do you know when to stop?
Yeah.
When you have enough yet.
I think it's about fundamentally waking up to the news, period. And I know some people who need to wake up to bad news, like I said, or in my own case. I think there's a place for waking up to bad news. And if you are trustworthy, if you know in your heart that you do see the bad, your bad news, pragmatically defined bad, in other words, that which leads to suffering or harm for yourself or others, you know, then you can trust yourself that I will see the danger. Myself, personally, I've done a lot of rock climbing and taken hundreds of people climbing. I'm very alert to danger. But because I'm so alert, I'm quite confident out there. little story. I was once traveling with my father to Sequoia National Park, and there were some large domes, and there was a restaurant near this dome. And while my dad, who's older than me, and this he was then probably in his early 80s, hung out at the whatever, the restaurant, the lounge, I wanted to go for a little walk. So I went out on the edge of this dome, and there was this big kind of sidewalk that was ranged probably from 6 to 2 feet wide that kind of went around this curvy dome. So if you imagine, from my dad's perspective, he's at the restaurant here, the dome's here, he's looking this way, and there's this kind of path around the side of the dome. And so I go out on the path, I go out to the point where it narrows and you can't go any further. I'm completely comfortable. I mean, if I jumped, I would die. It was a multi-hundred foot drop, but I was fine. It was totally okay. You know, I knew what I was doing. It was all good. Came back, and my dad said, Rick, you won't believe what we all saw. Some maniac was out on the dome, risking his life. Some harebrained fool, right? That was me. And see, to my dad, he thought, not irrationally, that there was some maniac, you know, playing out on the edge of a drop that was hundreds and hundreds of feet. It was a death fall for sure if I had tipped over. But there was no way I was going to tip over on what I was kind of walking on. And so I had, as it were, woken up, awoken from that bad dream that he was, in a sense, caught in. So when we know, when we can trust ourselves to know where the bad news is, we can afford to not be caught up in the bad news nightmare. You know. And second, of course, be careful about addiction to carrots. You know. But so much of what we can wake up to, the good news that we can wake up to, is wholesome. They love you. You are a good person. If you try hard, there will probably be fruits. I was talking with someone previously about writing a book. It's amazing to realize if you sit down and write about 500 words a day, that's a page, roughly, and you do that for 100 days, that's a 50,000 word book. Whoa, that's 3 months, 3.5 months of writing. A little bit added up every day. If you practice, if you meditate every day, it adds up over time. You know? If you bring love to your partner or your relationships every day, it gradually accumulates over time. If you do a little art every day, it adds up over time. This is wholesome, and we tend to not become addicted to what's wholesome. It's like, do you trust yourself to wake up to good news? A lot of us don't trust her. That's kind of what you're getting in a sense. Gee, I don't know if I can trust myself to wake up to the good news, because I might stop seeing the bad news, and I might get addicted and greedy for the good news. Isn't that interesting? Can you trust yourself to wake up to the good news? The good news of not so many threats, lots more opportunities, you're surrounded by love, and you're a good person. Okay? One more, and then I'll go to the next level I warned you about.
So
Arietta.
On a superficial level, in the last couple of months, I took on a project with some young colleagues who were just overwhelmed by a difficult challenge and this large project. And I took the project and I thought, well, this could be sort of career suicide, or, you know, I could trust myself. And I did trust myself. And, you know, being here as much as I can helped a lot. And I've had the happy pleasure of seeing all of us start to look at the positive opportunities that we're facing. And the young people that I'm working with have gotten much more sort of engaged and energized, and I think we've turned the Titanic.
Great.
I just realized it today. It was wonderful.
That's great, and that's an example of seeing the good possibility. A lot of the good news is the possibility of good. You know, it's not necessarily a guarantee, but a possibility is infinitely more appealing than no possibility at all. You know. To maybe finish on this section, I'll make a couple points from what you just said. So when you go home tonight or are walking around, working, doing whatever, tomorrow, you might ask yourself, or if you're in a situation, you're in some sort of moment with someone else, or you're dealing with an email, or you're worrying about something, or you're irritated about something, or you're grappling with something, ask yourself the obvious question. What are the limiting beliefs running here? What are my assumptions? Right? What am I assuming? And then really ask yourself, is it the truth? Is it actually the truth? And what might be the more positive possibility? It's a little bit like that story of these tigers. I believe it's a true story, Berlin Zoo tigers that were in cages their whole life. And at great expense, the city built this large fenced-in park around them. And then they pulled the bars of the cages, but the tigers would not go outside because they were trained to stay inside the bars of their cage, which were no longer now present. It was an illusion. What are the non-existent, delusional bars of our own cage in terms of limiting beliefs? And then the other suggestion I have is take little risks. Take little chances. See what happens. Bet on yourself. I just think that so often our lamest bet, we don't bet on ourselves. I speak from personal experience. We lose our nerve, we play small, we don't bet on ourselves. Bet on yourself. We bet on others, we give them good chances, we know what that's like. We love it when people bet on us, when they have faith in us. Do we have faith in ourselves? And what could happen if we wake up to good news? Now, for the deeper end of the pool. So, why do we crave? Buddha said, craving is the root of suffering. Why do we crave and what do we crave? I think we crave fundamentally for biological reasons over which psychology is laid. And it relates to three fundamental issues. Issue number one is that biologically, organisms, whether they're a single cell protozoan or even a virus, let alone a larger creature like us, a large mammal, large land mammal, must differentiate themselves from the world. They must create a separation, a boundary, a dualism. Right? And laid on top of that physical boundary, and that, by the way, has to happen at many levels in our own physiology. You know, the kidneys must distinguish themselves from not kidney, right? Oxygen in the hemoglobin, if you will, the red blood cells must distinguish oxygen from carbon dioxide. There are all these distinctions that have to be made, all these separations that have to occur at 10,000 levels in the architecture of a complex organism like us. All right. A second major need, and then laid on top of that is psychology. We have to distinguish one thought from another to understand my words. You have to parse and differentiate a stream of speech sounds. We have to psychologically recognize that your thoughts are not my thoughts. If I think I'm thinking your thoughts, you know, I think that the TV broadcaster is putting thoughts in my mind, that's psychotic, that's schizophrenic, okay? We have to do these differentiations. Second, we have to stabilize. All life has to stabilize healthy equilibria around a healthy set point, staying within range, and not changing chaotically, right? Life has to do that. And again, we do that psychologically as well. We can't change too quickly. When we form a view, we can't just forget it when we wake up the next morning. We have to stabilize. You can watch in the mind this ongoing effort to make sense of the world by stabilizing percepts, ideas, or images, or categories. That in Buddhist psychology is the third aggregate of perception, of labeling things, of categorizing, of sorting. It's a this. It's a man. That's a woman. That's a Rick. That's a you. Okay. And then the third need, biologically, is to acquire rewards, avert harms, and attach to others. We must do that. Well, here's the problem. When those strategies are fulfilled, they're is a sense of all rightness. But when those strategies, in other words, to separate self and world, to stabilize things in a good place and hold them there, and third, to acquire rewards, avert harms, and attach to others. When we do that, it's good. But when that's at all disturbed, when that need is challenged in any way, alarm bells go off at different levels in the architecture. A lot of them go off deep in the biology when the carbon dioxide saturation in the blood rises above a certain level, like a thermostat setting, an alarm goes off and we yawn, for example, or we take a deeper breath to get more oxygen in. Higher up, alarm bells are experienced as conscious pain or emotional pain. Okay? Here's the problem, though. Each one of those needs flies in the face of the truth of things. First need is to separate at many, many levels, and yet everything is allness. Everything is connected to everything else. To be a living organism, we must exchange continually with the world. That's what metabolism is. You know, oxygen in, CO2 out. Food in, waste products out. We've got to continually exchange. We recycle molecules in our body over the course of a year, particularly in more fluid systems like organs or muscles. I forget what it is exactly. I think there's something like 100,000 blood cells built every minute or second because they live for 20 minutes or 20 days. Forgive me, but I forget. It's very quick. There's a lot of turnover. So right there, there's a problem. How do we separate from everything psychologically and physically when truly we're so interconnected? The second problem is to stabilize things. How do we stabilize equilibria biologically and mentally in a world that's marked by impermanence, by a reality that's marked by endless change? Right? That's a challenge, and that sets off alarm bells. And third, how do we hold on to rewards, you know, that are slipping through our fingers as quickly as we grasp them in our own experience? They don't last forever. All pleasures end eventually. As a surgeon client of mine once said to me, Rick, we have a saying in the OR, all bleeding stops eventually, one way or another. You know? On the other hand, harms. We're all subject to the three messengers of old age, disease, and death, right? We're all subject to physical discomforts of one kind or another. We all get older and creakier eventually. And then in terms of attachments to other, one way or another, we will all be separated from those we love one way or another, one day, right? Craving is driven to try to maintain the first condition of separation, the second condition of stability, and the third condition of acquiring rewards, averting harms, and attaching to others. That's what craving's about. But you can see the fundamental problem, that the thing we crave for is ultimately impossible. Any success we achieve in separating self and world, stabilizing equilibria psychologically and physically, or acquiring rewards, averting harms, or attaching to others, anything we ever attain through those cravings, any result we ever achieve through those cravings, is transient and doomed, and eventually, quickly, will pass through our fingers. Thus, we suffer. What's the way out? The good news is it's actually okay to be one with everything. The good news is that you can actually feel it, that it's okay to let things change. Because underneath it all is that which doesn't change, which is the nature of things, ultimately going down into the unconditioned. It's okay to relax the craving in this radical way. And in terms of, you know, the third category, which includes A, acquiring rewards, it's okay if we don't get those rewards because we're already so full. This moment, the stimuli of this moment, the sensations, the sounds, the sights, the richness, is already arrived here. we're already profoundly full. I was reflecting a little earlier that if you think about like a lifetime sensuality rating, you know, lifetime hedonism rating in terms of foods eaten, music heard, sights seen, smells smelled, beauty known, the mind delighted, entertained. The least hedonically fulfilled person in this room has had a richer life than any king or queen a couple hundred years ago ever dreamed of. Think about it. We eat better than Louis XIV, you know? The music we hear is much more extraordinary than any king or queen ever heard. I mean, so we've already gotten so much. And then in terms of the second issue, averting the harms, you know, the truth is that even if, you know, harms land, eventually we're going to be okay anyway. We really are. We're part of everything. You know, we swirled together for a while. We'll disperse eventually. All eddies disperse eventually. And that, too, is really okay because deep down fundamentally, there's a place that itself is never in pain. There's a consciousness and awareness that itself is never in pain. And then last, the connection attaching to others. We're fundamentally related. We're already profoundly related. We're already loved, and more broadly, we're already connected to everything. So it's okay at the deepest level to wake up to the good news that we're already, you know, involved in allness. Our fundamental nature is reliably stable and good. You know, the rewards that we want have already filled us. The harms, when they eventually land, will still be fundamentally all right. And we're profoundly already connected to everything. And when we feel this, these are just words. Important thing is to go into the experience of it or open to the possibility of it. Wow, if I relax my craving to separate, if I relax my craving to stabilize, and to have, if I relax my craving related to pushing away the unpleasant and holding on to the pleasant, what do I have? And what we have is what the Buddha called the highest happiness, which is peace. You can feel it. It's that profound peace of equanimity. You're not engaged with craving. You've woken up to the good news at the deepest level that it's really, really okay. And there's no need fundamentally to crave. And that is a profound peace and freedom. We can taste it. And then we have to, of course, expand it in our life, string those pearls of moments together into a continuous necklace of seconds of lived experience. But that opportunity is available to all of us because it's grounded in the deep truth of things. The deep truth of things is that, right, everything's connected. You know, everything changes on the surface, but what's underneath that is enduring and stable and a reliable basis for deep happiness. And we're going to be fine, even if we don't get the carrots and we can't avert the sticks. I'm very happy about that myself. What do you think? And then we'll wrap it up. I know it's a little out there, but try to let it be real. See what happens if you personally soften around letting it land. In other words, it's kind of like part of waking up to the good news is letting the bad news, the ostensible bad news, land. You know, it's like when I was a kid, one of the bravest things I've ever done in my life, maybe even braver than the first time I told a girl I loved her. It scared me silly, 15. Is one time I was very, very scared. I was maybe 11 or so, I don't know, 12, maybe a little older. I was terrified there was a monster under my bed, some kind of dark supernatural spirit. And finally, I just had it. And I basically leaned over. You know how vulnerable you are when you lean over and you put your head under your bed? And I basically said, if you're there, get me. I give up. So I opened to the bad news. I opened to the bad news. And no monster under my bed. Some dust bunnies, but no monster under the bed. So anyway, it's like opening to the bad news. Like I'll fall apart. I'll die. I'll end. My body will break. You know, if I drop the craving that's involved in this doomed quest to separate and stabilize and get and ward off, you know, if I just drop that, what's left? Wow. Great peace, great freedom, and love. Love amazingly comes forward because it's no longer held down by the invisible strings like Gulliver that tie us down that actually are not truly there. We can just stand up and wake up to good news instead.
Can we end on a note of humor?
I've had a little humor here, Marian, but bring it on.
I have a very old friend who says, if I wake up and I look up and the ceiling is still in my room, I am happy.
That's great. I'm there. Thank you very much. That's really good. That's great. Hey, one last person.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Did the tigers eventually get out?
I don't know that story. I really don't. I was told as if it were true. I can't imagine that eventually they wouldn't. Partly because, of course, the park officials want the tigers to get out. You know, the ticket holders want to see their tigers. So I don't know. But I assume eventually they got out. But it's a deep metaphor, though. You know, to just think about it metaphorically, what are the presumed bars of our own cage? You know, what are the dreaded experiences that we fear will happen if we risk full self-expression? How about we sit for a minute and let this sink in? Helping this be more real for yourself and your own experience, you might just simply explore what happens when you sort of soften and fall open in a way. Let yourself fall open, relaxing clinging, relaxing craving, relaxing seeking, relaxing ordering or making sense or holding anything together in the mind. Just letting the mind fall open, letting go of control, and risking the bad news. And then noticing that as you do this, you're actually ongoing, you go on being, the world keeps carrying you, oxygen keeps arriving, people keep loving you. You can really fall open wide out into reality. To, as the Dogen said, to be illuminated by all things, opening wide, falling out, being illuminated by all things. Thank you. Good news.